Hello everyone, this is Flo.
And this is Jesse.
And we're already back with another episode of the Great War Podcast. We're very happy to have a look with our interview partner at a more forgotten topic, forgotten front when it comes to World War I, and then even diving so deep that we go into a forgotten topic within the forgotten front. Everything is forgotten.
It's the inception of forgetfulness, I guess. But yeah, I really had a great time talking to Gwendal Pieguet, who's our guest, about the Balkan front, and more particularly about the Russians who got sent there and all the reasons behind that, all the difficulties of inter-allied coordination in Macedonia with all the different nationalities, including these Russians on the front. And it's of particular interest to me because I have a family connection there. So it was quite cool.
Yeah, I found it quite fascinating how it started with no one had a clue what to do at that front, into like a major military operation. And then I think kind of the Russian revolutions kind of derailed this thing for the Russian soldiers there. And at some point, apparently vodka was traded. So that's all you need to know as a hook. Enjoy the interview. Once again, we do appreciate if you support us on Patreon. If you support us on Patreon, you can ask historians like Gwendal and all our other guests in the future questions about the topics that they are researching. And if you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes, actually, or on wherever you listen to this podcast, because that helps other people finding the podcast. That would be much appreciated. And without further ado, here is the interview.
Hello, everyone. I'm very happy to welcome our guest for today, who is a doctoral candidate at the University of Brest in France. His name is Gwendal Pieguet, and his area of specialization is the Balkan Front in Macedonia, and more particularly the Russian expeditionary forces that ended up there. We're going to talk a little bit more about that. He has also published several articles in academic journals on that and some other World War I topics. So, Gwendal, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks to you.
All right. So let's jump right into it. We've got a few questions from viewers and a few that I slipped in. I should mention, by the way, that I'm particularly happy to be dealing with this topic because I have a distant relative by marriage, not by blood, but nonetheless, who served in the French artillery in the French Army of the Orient in the Balkans. So this is kind of a cool area for me to learn a bit more about as well. So here we go. Let's start it at the basics. How did you get interested in this topic of the Macedonian front and the Russians who ended up being sent there? What drew you to that area?
When I have started to study the First World War, I was more focusing on the history of the German army, and especially on the phenomenon of desertion among the ranks of the Imperial Army. But I had and I still have a strong interest in the history of Russia. I was fond of Russian history and literature. I was reading a lot about Russia and the Eastern Front when I started my master thesis. And also in all my readings, I was always very curious about the Macedonian Front, about the Front d'Orient, as we say in French. But it was a front that was always briefly mentioned, insisting on the fact that it was an important one, but not giving the specifics and all the details. I also heard in my family, I heard a lot about this front because my great-grandfather, he was on this front in the French Navy. And during all my readings, I always thought that it was a fascinating place and moment of the Great War. Imagine this front line going from the north of Valona in Albania nowadays, crossing all the Balkans through Monastir, through the Prespa Lakes, not in the south of Uskub, and going on the other side of the Balkan Peninsula, and just imagine this front with Bulgarian soldiers, French soldiers, British, Serbians, Russians, of course Ottomans also, and Germans, Austro-Hungarians, all these people and fighting on this front, where you also had colonial armies coming from Africa, from Vietnam, and so on. And this is a front that is quite well pictured in the French movie Capitaine Conan by Bertrand Tavernier, which I really advise the audience to watch, which is one, up to me, one of the best movies about the Great War that has been made in France. And when I was reading about this front, I discovered the story of these 24,000 soldiers, Russian soldiers, who were sent to fight in the French forces in Macedonia. I thought this is the perfect match for like my interest for Russia. I have started to learn Russian language at this point, and my interest for this front. So that's it. That's what made the PhD topic.
All right. So a conjoncture of interests, one might say. Right. So let's get into the strategy level a little bit. What was the goal of the French Army of the Orient in the Balkan Peninsula? And do you think that it was achieved in the end? Or did the front remain, as it is sometimes called in English literature, a so-called sideshow?
The idea to intervene in the Balkans is quite old. In fact, at the beginning of the war, in the autumn 1914, in the French army, someone like Franchet Desprez, the French general, proposed to intervene directly in the Balkans in the fall of 1914 to help the Serbian army, and maybe to break the line at this point, a decisive blow. The idea was also in the Russian army to help directly the Serbian forces. And on the British side, you of course know very well the idea to intervene against the Ottoman Empire with the Dardanelles, as we say in French, and the Gallipoli operation. But for a long time, it was excluded by the French army, because the idea was that the main front remains in Belgium and remains on the Western Front. But finally, it was the Bulgarian attack against Serbia, which caused the collapse of the Serbian army in the summer and the fall of 1915, which creates some kind of a precipitation of all these plans that were proposed, and the Serbian army asked for help to the French forces, who sent in quite a precipitated manner around 70,000 men to help the Serbian army. A big part of them came directly from Gallipoli, so you had troops who were already fighting against the Ottoman troops, British and French ones, that were in the Dardanelles. They arrived in October 1915 in Thessaloniki, in Salonika, and they tried to establish contact with the Serbian army to try to recreate a front line to hold against the Central Powers. This operation failed because the Serbian army had to retreat all through the Albanian mountains, which is called the Golgota, which was an episode during which the Serbian army lost a tremendous number of soldiers, also civilians. All you can imagine, an entire state of Serbia, like flying, going to escape to the Bulgarian advance. It was not a complete failure, because thanks to the Italian Navy, and the French one, they managed to evacuate all the Serbian army to Corfu, but the goal to save Serbia was almost a complete failure. But on the other hand, it would have been a political disaster for the French and the British army to say, okay, now we go back to France, we go back to England, and everything is done, game over. So they decided to stay. They decided to create some kind of an entrenched camp around the city of Salonika and to stay here until it would be possible to organize some new operations. And the problem is that at this point, the French army, the French Armée d'Orient and all the allied troops were commanded by the General Sarraï, who was the head of the French Armée d'Orient and then to the head of the Allied forces. But for no one, there was no clear plan. So we are here, we don't really have the forces to organize a decisive offensive, and no one in France is quite comfortable with the idea of feeding a second front. And at this point, the British start to have some other thoughts about, for example, Mesopotamia and the other front in Egypt. So during this period, you have no real no concrete goal, and they are here. You can't make them go back because it would admit that it's failure. And moreover, you have the delicate situation that Greece, where they arrived, was a neutral state. So Sarraï was quite clear that if you want to do something about this front, you must give me more men. When he arrives, he has barely 70 or 80,000 men under his command. And he says, I can't do anything about this front without more men. And I can't do anything if the political situation of Greece is not more clear. If on my back you have a neutral state who suddenly can go on the side of the central power, it would be a great, great problem. But many politicians in France decided that it could be interesting to have this force in Greece and on the Macedonian front to push some states in the Balkans to come on the side of the Allies. For example, Romania. Romania was one of the greatest hopes of the French diplomacy during the year 1916. The French politicians had great expectations about the coming into on the side of the Allies of Romania. And when Joffre at the Chantilly conference decided that they would organize a great offensive in 1916, the Macedonian front had a role in that part that was mainly to retain troops of the Central Powers in Macedonia while the great and decisive attack would come from the West. So the Macedonian front remained here, but only with a secondary role, not a main one. Mm-hmm. It became another thing than a sideshow, and it became a more important front when finally in June 1917 the Allied succeeded to bring Greece into the war, and when Sarraï, which was not a great general at managing his officers, his troops, was removed and replaced by the French general Guillaume. At this point, he started to reorganize the French army, but also the inter-allied cooperation on this front that was from December 1917 to, June 1918. And then a new French general after Guillaume arrived at the head of the Armée d'Orient and more precisely at the head of the Allied armies of the Orient, and decided to to give to this army a decisive role and to organize an offensive in the Balkans in 1918, which totally broke the Bulgarian lines and pushed the Bulgarian to ask for an armistice. So we can say that it started as a rescue operation, which failed, and the situation remained unclear for a long period, but it's only at the end of 1917 when the French army tried to reorganize this front, and when a French general, the general Franchet Desprez, arrived at the head of this army in June 1918, that he gave to this army a role that he had not in the past.
All right, the Allies seem to definitely take their time in terms of their strategy in some cases. I read that, I think there's like a famous quote that the Allied forces at Salonika were like the biggest prisoner camp that the Central Powers had, or something.
Absolutely.
Along those lines.
Absolutely.
Let's jump into the Russians now. How did they end up sending these 24,000 men to the Balkans? And I think they also sent an expeditionary corps to France to fight on the Western Front as well. So how did that come about, that the Russians end up sending men kind of halfway around the continent to fight with the French?
Well, as I said, the idea of an intervention in the Balkans was not new, and it was in the heads and the minds of French generals, but it was also an idea proposed by many Russian diplomats and mainly ambassadors like Trubetskoy, like the Russian Foreign Affairs Minister Sergei Satsonov, and by the Russian ambassador in Paris, Izvolsky. The main idea was to send troops to support the Serbian army during the winter 1914-1915, and once again proposed when the Serbian front was collapsing. On the French side, there was a desperate need for men. The battles of 1914 and 1915 were terrible blows for the French army, with high numbers of casualties, and they wanted to ask Russian part to give them men to fight on the Western Front, and they were not that happy about the idea to have these Russian men in the French army and to send them in the Balkans, while up to the French generals like Joffre, the main priority was the Western Front. But on the other hand, during the summer 1915, Russia was defeated on the battlefields of Golestano, went through the what do they call the Great Retreat, and they lost Poland, where they had very strong industrial capacities, and suddenly they needed to ask for the French ally and the British ally, and also to partners like the United States, to give them more guns, more ammunition, and so on. So the French army proposed an agreement: we give you more, even more shells, guns, and whatever you need, if you give us men. The Russian generals were not comfortable at all with this idea, because Alexeyev, who was now at the head of the Russian army at the end of 1915, said clearly that we have no resources to send troops on other fronts, and we have other priorities. Moreover, Alexeyev was quite skeptical about the idea that a decisive blow could be given to the Central Powers on the Western Front, because for him the front was stuck. Like, everyone is blocked. You have no tactical idea of how to solve this. While on the Eastern Front, it's still half mobile war. We can build a strategy with this. And also was agreed with French generals like Franchet Desprez, saying that something could be done with the Balkans. If you attract
Romania on the side of the Allies, you can create a southern front if you create a connection between the Romanian and the Russian forces on one side and the French and British soldiers and after the Serbians who are fighting on the Balkan side. So he said the more interesting possibilities are not necessarily on the Western Front, and moreover, I don't have any men to give you. But the diplomats in Petrograd were not felt that they could not say no to the French colleagues, because French was about to give more materials, was about to give more guns, and so on. And it was politically very complicated to say no. So with the help of the Tsar, who was quite we liked the idea to help Serbia, they said, let's give half to the Balkans and half to France. And we will see if we can give more in the times to come. And we must not forget that at the moment where this agreement is made, the agreement was established in the spring in 1916. The negotiations had started in the winter 1915-1916. At this moment, Russia was trying to secure gains for the afterwar, gains taken to the Ottoman Empire, and up to Satsonov and all the politicians, it was politically a good idea to send troops in the Balkans if after the war you would need to secure the gains you have obtained during negotiations with France and the British Empire. So finally, they made this agreement, and at during the summer 1916, Russia sent troops from Arkhangelsk, which is a neighbor in the north of Russia, going to Brest, so at the other side of Europe, and another part of these brigades. So there were four brigades sent to France and Balkans. And another part of the brigades took the Trans-Siberian and went to Dalny and a boat through the Indian Ocean, the Suez Canal, the Mediterranean, arrived in Marseille where they finally reached the French army.
That is quite the round-the-world trip to end up. That's quite the odyssey. Now, once the Russian brigades end up in the Balkans, in Macedonia, how is their performance? Because I can imagine that there would have been some challenges fighting alongside French troops, which are probably trained differently, probably equipped perhaps slightly differently. What was their battlefield performance judged?
So, in matters of equipment, everything is given by the French army. So the guns, the uniforms, not all the uniforms, but the helmets and so on. And they are trained by the French army in camps in Russian bases, which are created on the French territory. You have a big Russian base in Laval, a big one in Mailly, another in the Cournot. And in these camps, they are trained by French officers who were working with French interpreters who were here to translate all the tactical handbooks, all the maps. And so it was quite a business, because before the war, no one had imagined that this kind of things could happen. And it's more or less the same thing in the Balkans. When they arrive, they are sent to the camp of Zeitelnik, which is the big ally camp in the north of Salonika. And there they live with British troops, French troops, Serbian ones. And the cooperation is even more complex, because you have a real Babel army, like I don't know how many languages you have to handle. So all the trainings are organized by the French army, but in France they are trained for weeks and after sent to the battlefield. In the Balkans, the army was already in the rush, which is to say when half of the Russian soldiers arrived in Salonika, they just have time to organize a parade to show the beautiful Russian troops arriving in Salonika, and then they are directly sent to into the mountains, which was also another problem because the reserve of the Russian troops trained to fight in the mountains was not that huge, and it was necessary to create a complete training for them also. But when we arrived to the fighting, all the French generals and officers agreed to say that all these troops fought bravely. For example, when they were sent to fight with the Serbians and with the French in the city to take back the city of Florina and then move north to take the city of Bitola monastery in the north of Greece. So all this front line is mainly located in what is nowadays the border between northern Macedonia and Greece. So it's more or less the same places. And so when they are sent to these battles, even Sarai said, like in the Hellenic mountains, as in the Serbian plain, your legendary bravery has never wavered. So the French generals were quite happy about the behavior and the performances of the Russian army on this front. The main problem remained inter-allied cooperation. You have a French artillery which have to synchronize with the Russian troops moving forwards, covered by the Serbian flank. So everything remained complex, created tensions between officers, and it's enough to open a box in the French military archives or in the Russian military archives to find maps where you can see Serbian translated in Russian, translated in French. All these remain very complex. And even if French was the language the most commonly shared by Serbian officers, Russian officers, and their French colleagues, to implement this into the troops remain very complicated, and moreover, on a front where in the Balkans you have not that much permissions, you can not give some rest to all the soldiers, and this creates a lot of tensions that, of course, reduces the performances of your army.
Yeah. The lack of leave time, lack of furlough is definitely always a killer for soldiers' morale. It kind of sounds to me, as you're describing these difficulties overcoming the language barrier for units that need to cooperate, it reminds me of kind of the Austro-Hungarian experience as well. We had a guest not so long ago on the podcast, Dr. Scheer, who specializes in language in Austria-Hungary. And so, yeah, she talked to us a bit about that as well. Now, what happens when the Russian Revolution breaks out? How does this have an impact then on the officers and men in these Russian units in the Balkan front? How do they react?
So we must recall that in the year 1917, you had two revolutions, and the first one, the February Revolution, so happened in February, March for us, when the Russian Tsar abdicates. And the news of the revolution arrived in France and in the Balkans a few days after it happened. So the news reached the soldiers, like, let's say, a week or a few days after. And at the beginning, you can see among the ranks two reactions. The first one is sadness. Many soldiers, some good picture of the Tsar, and felt like some kind of fear also. But on the other side, there was also some kind of joy, because suddenly the army published the precast number one, which is a precast. It's like an order factor in Russian. And the precast number one stipulated that there would not be a mistreatment from the officers to the soldiers, and that now soldiers were authorized, if not pushed to take part in political debates. So the curious thing is that suddenly you have these Russian troops on the Macedonian front, and you have Soviets, like Council of Soldiers, of Russian soldiers, which are coming like mushrooms, like all over the front line, in small Macedonian villages where they are addressed, in the trenches. And you have some kind of a political life that arrives. But, well, I say political life, but it was also more simple debates about food, about news from the country, about very daily issues. You also have newspapers coming to the front, and new ideas start to be exchanged between the soldiers. So at this point, it was not a problem. Like, and moreover, the February revolutions happens in February, March, and news arrived in Macedonia after. And at the spring 1917, Sarai launched an offensive against Bulgarians, and the Russian soldiers behave normally. You have no insubordination, not that much, and not much than it used to. You always have troubles with troops in some ways. Would it be a revolution or not? So it was a bit business as usual. Moreover, the position of the provisional government, diplomatically speaking, was not a very different one from the imperial time. So the big change did not happen at this moment. It happened when all the news arrived in the Balkans. For example, when the soldiers learned about the coup of the summer 1917, when the military tried to remove Kerensky from power with the coup of the General Kornilov. And it was very embarrassing for the officers in the Balkans, which started to feel like some opposition to their rank. At the same time, everyone started to be quite tired of the war, tired of being far from home. Moreover, not all the Russian troops was authorized to go to Salonika to have some rest. So all these tensions began to grow. And moreover, the soldiers started to ask to take part in the political process that was happening in Russia. They even organized some kind of a committee of a delegation to go to Russia, go back to Russia to take part in the Constitutional Assembly that was supposed to create a constitution for the new Russian state. So at the summer of 1917, you can really feel the tension. And moreover, they are on the front line in front of the Bulgarians, and the Bulgarian soldiers start at the summer 1917 to send propaganda to the Russian soldiers, and saying, while you are here in Macedonia, they are starting to share the land, they are starting to gain new rights and so on, and so what are you doing here? Which is quite ironic, because when they sent the Russian troops in the Balkans, they saw that this would give a good morale to the Serbian ally, and that would terrify the Bulgarian enemy. And suddenly it was right the opposite that was happening. In September, October, the propaganda starts to be quite effective. You have reports about fraternizations on the front line between Bulgarian soldiers and Russian soldiers, exchanging bread, vodka, wine, and things like that. And suddenly, you have the Bolshevik coup, and Lenin asks for peace. And what do the Bulgarian, when they hear about that? They send messages all along the front line to the Russian troops to say, peace has been asked. An armistice will be concluded. So Russia is not at war anymore. And suddenly, no one wants to fight. And the Russian soldiers refused to follow the French orders. And they even started to oppose physically to their French colleagues.
That is quite an extreme change of affairs. And sort of following up on that, once the Bolshevik coup slash revolution occurs then in October and Russia begins to withdraw from the war, once that starts to get wrapped up, what happens with those Russian soldiers? Do most of them go back to Russia? Do most of them end up in exile somewhere? Do the officers go one place and the men go another place? Or what's their kind of final destiny?
The end will be longer because it became even more complicated because the French general Sarai made an inspection on the front line. He saw that even before the Bolshevik coup that discipline was not here anymore. All the front line was kind of in danger with this discipline issue, and he said that sooner or later we'll have to withdraw all these troops. The problem is, as I said earlier, that Sarai had no reserves. The France and the British Empire were not giving enough soldiers to give rest to some and to send others to the front. So suddenly remove like around 15,000 soldiers, Russian soldiers who are on the front line, it seems to everyone impossible. And that's why all these Russian soldiers, even undisciplined, even refusing to fight, remained on the front for a very long time. When Sarai is removed, because he was seen in London as in Paris as an incompetent general, and he started to argue with all his officers, even the closest friends, and the relations with the British troops were terrible at this point of the war, and they sent the general Guillaume, who arrived at the end of December 1917. And when he saw that, he said, "We have to do something. We have to remove all of them." So he took a big part of his colonial troops and colonial reserves, and sent his troops to remove manu militari all these Russian soldiers, expecting that it could be a violent episode. It could some troubles could happen. All along the front line, he sent these troops to remove the Russians, and in some places it was a mess. Like everyone refusing to do what they were asked to. And on other part, when the French said, "So Russia is out of war. You are going out of war now. Please come," and it happened more easily. Once you say to these Russian soldiers, "The war is over for you," they accept to come and they hope to go back to Russia as soon as possible. You even have some units who were half drunk already and who went out of the trenches screaming and yelling and saying, "We finally go to Russia," and there was some kind of joy at this moment. You also had episode where the Bulgarian knew that the situation was not that well on the front, and they tried to attack the positions, and that really endangered the front line on several points. But once all these soldiers were taken from the front line, you also have to take all the soldiers who were addressed in the villages of Macedonia, where the Russian kind of created some kind of Russian life in these places with their Soviets, with their councils, with their meetings. And so it was a real police operation to clean all these villages from the Russian troops. But once all gathered, the French army asked to the Russian soldiers to choose between three categories. Either you are you still want to fight and you can be a volunteer in the Légion Française, in the Légion Étrangère, and we create a Russian Legion in the in the French army, or you accept to work for the French army. The French army at this moment had a lot to do in Greece with maintaining roads, building others, to clean rivers, to create bridges, and so on. So they really needed manpower also on this working front, I would say. And the others, the people, the soldiers that were too undisciplined, not listen a word or an order coming from the French army, they were sent to forced labor in northern Africa or in some camps in the Greek forest or in the Greek islands. So they divided all these soldiers in three categories, and it remained a bit like this until the end of the war. They were sent to Russia, they were sent back to Russia only in 1919 and 1920, when the French government accepted to give them back to Bolshevik and to Soviet Russia in exchange of French civilians who were detained in Petrograd and in Moscow under the custody of the Soviet authorities, and about 3,000 Russian soldiers remain in France. They remain in France for many reasons. On the French side, also you had mutinies, and the soldiers were given the same choice between the three categories, and a lot of them became workers in French villages, in factories. There they met women, they got married. So that's for the part of the soldiers, one of the main reasons. And the other big part who never came back to Russia was, of course, the officers. Many of them even went into the White Forces during the Russian Civil War. For example, one of the brigades on the French front was commanded by the General Marushevsky, who became one of the main generals, Russian generals during the Russian Civil War on the Northern Front near Petrograd, Finland, and in the Baltic and what would become the Baltic states. And on the Macedonian side, the Russian part of this expeditionary force, commanded by the General Diterix, who was one of the last white Russian general to hold what could be a decent army, but far in Asia. So you can see that many of these officers have chosen to go on a side of another of the Russian Civil War. You have another example. It is the soldier Malinovsky, who later became the a marshal of the Soviet Union, and he was Khrushchev's defense minister. He was a soldier in the Russian Expeditionary Force in France. So you can see like some different trajectories between these different officers.
That is quite a fascinating part. That might be one of the most interesting aspects of the whole thing, is how it ended, and the sort of the destinies of those who ended up stuck in all these places. And it kind of brings us full circle from starting with talking about these ideas in 1914 about, you know, what to do, where we could send troops, and ending up with the Russian Civil War, which of course we've been covering in the video episodes quite intensely over the past year. So thank you so much for talking to us today and sharing all of this cool stuff that's part of your PhD research.
If for our viewers who are more interested in kind of following up and maybe becoming a bit more familiar with the research that you've done, how can they find you? I mean, you're active on Twitter. I guess we can probably put a link there somewhere.
Yeah. Yes, you can find me quite easily on Twitter. And if you're interested in by this topic, I post quite regularly, if not daily, stuff about the Macedonian front, and also about the history of Russia, and also how is it to do research about Russian history,
which is a saga unto itself, I suppose, sometimes. All right, thank you once again, Gwendal, for joining us, and we appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you very much.